You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 127. Covering the week of June 25th through June 29th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute. You can like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and you can subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. If you want to go out and search for all those things, just go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you've got all our social media buttons. You can also give us an email address there, and we'll give you our free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell, and you get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday with a link to this podcast. Also remember that we exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like what we do, if you like our podcast, our website, our conferences, our programs, please consider making a generous contribution to the Abbeville Institute. You can find the way to do that at abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support and donor options. We have a new donor interface, so you can use a credit card through Stripe or PayPal. I know some people have been resistant to use PayPal, so we have that option. You can also mail a check. So all that information is there. Please consider making a donation. Also, you can support the Institute by buying your Abbeville Institute apparel at the top of the page where it also says support. There is a button that says shop. So click on that and you can go out and get all of our embroidered apparel, golf shirts, t-shirts, hats, a lot of great stuff there. So go out and get that too. Wear your Abbeville Institute apparel out and let people know that you support us and what we are. I think that's a nice way to do it. Also, you can download our app, our web application. Just go to your favorite app store, whether it's Google Play, iTunes. You can get the Abbeville Institute app. So you can have the website on the go. You also get a podcast, the podcasts and our lectures through that as well. So a lot of great audio material while you're riding in the car or on your commute, on the train, whatever it is. You can have the Abbeville Institute on the go. And, of course, it also gives you a way to access the website. And don't forget, we have our summer school coming up in just a couple of weeks. They're only, if you're listening to this podcast before the summer school in this week of June 25th through 29th, we only have 4 spots left. So 4 spots for the summer school. You can still get in, but there are not many left. Also, we have our banquet, which is on the Wednesday the 18th. Now, we are going to be selling tickets for that. They will be $70 for those who cannot attend the summer school, but you want to come out and see Bobby Horton and meet us and also, you know, support the Institute, support the students who are there. We will be selling tickets to the banquet alone for $70. So you just need to contact Dr. Livingston about that, and all of his information is available on the website. But we do have that option as well. So a lot of great stuff going on with the Institute. And don't forget that everything that we do, we've got a website with well over 1,000 articles now. I mean, it really is a virtual library. 1,000 articles. We have well over 100 lectures. All of that material is free. Free. So if you enjoy that material, please feel free to continue to do so. But if you do like it and you want to help us continue to do these things, again, think about a contribution to the Institute. You can give us as little as $3 a month if you're a student, or $5 a month if you're not a student, and you can help us continue to do what we're doing. So you don't have to give a lot of money up front. You can give it monthly and make it in your monthly bills, and as little as $5 a month, and it does help us do what we do. So we've got a beautiful website. This podcast, the programs that we do, all of that stuff, all the website and the podcast, all that's free. And it really is a benefit to the South and the people of the South. And I think the United States as a whole to have this expression of the Southern tradition. So, again, please consider making that contribution. Okay, well, let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. And it's kind of an eclectic week, but the bookends of the week, Monday and Friday, really work together. And what I mean by that is perception. And in so many ways, the problem with the South is perception. There is a perception of the South that's one way, and then there's reality. And so what we've got in America today is a perception problem. whether it's in politics, whether it's in social interaction, whether whatever the case is, you know, social, cultural, we have a perception problem. You have one side that firmly believes that the South is the evil other in America, that there's nothing in the Southern tradition that's valuable, that Southerners were just traitors, bad guys, awful people. And even moving forward, you always have to qualify your admiration for the South based on what we now call virtue signaling. So, well, yeah, I mean, the South is a good, I like it when the South is this, but otherwise they're just bad. I mean, I can't support the South. So you can't just have an unfiltered appreciation for the South. It always has to be, there's always a qualifier. There always has to be contextualization. That's virtue signaling. And you see it all the time. It was in my own podcast this week, I talked about a Time Magazine special edition on the founding generation. The entire issue is virtue signaling. Well, these guys are great, but there's all these things with them. And that's always the way the South is portrayed. So these are flawed people. I mean, we can admire them, but we have to admire them with a qualifier. And it all comes down to a perception that somehow the South was the only section, Southerners were the only people that had any type of racism in America. That's just simply not true. I mean, look, the entire history of the United States is, particularly in the 19th century, you could find very few people that were not racist in America at the time. Very few people. So that's the problem. It's perception. When somebody calls a Southerner a traitor in 1860, they lack perception. They lack perspective, and they lack an accurate perception of what the South was and what the South was trying to do. And the same thing goes with Confederate monuments, and not just that, with perception on abolition. So the piece on Monday actually riled some people up, and I was a little bit surprised by this, because the piece wasn't actually attacking anyone celebrating emancipation. In fact, the author of the piece at the end says, look, yeah, celebrate emancipation. It's a great thing, but you should do it in December, not June. The piece is entitled Juneteenth, A Celebration of Nothing. And so there were people that I received, you know, some emails from, there were some comments on social media, that Juneteenth is a celebration of something, particularly in Texas. So let's dive into this for a second. And what the author of the piece essentially is saying is that, look, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free one slave. And in fact, when the Emancipation Proclamation was read on June 19th in 1865 in Galveston, Texas, not one slave was still free. And in fact, the image of the on the piece comes from 1863 in Louisiana, where it was essentially saying, look, we're not going to allow slave owners to recapture slaves. We're not going to allow slave owners to use corporal punishment on slaves. But if a slave wants to stay on the plantation, they're more than welcome to do so. And if you are going to leave the plantation, guess what? You're going to work for the U.S. Army. Does that sound like freedom? Not much. And in June of 1865, Lincoln was already dead. The Emancipation Proclamation was no longer in effect. The war was over. The only thing that was going to end slavery at that point, in June of 1865, was the 13th Amendment. And so some people were bristling at this and saying, well, how dare you deny somebody celebrating their de facto freedom? Well, because were they de facto free? I mean, I guess theoretically there's no more slavery. However, slavery hadn't been abolished and, in fact, still existed in several states all the way up till December of 1865. The issue is not necessarily with Texas. The issue is with all these other states that now use Juneteenth as a day to celebrate emancipation, when emancipation didn't happen then. So that's the issue. It's a perception issue. Slavery didn't end officially in the United States until December of 1865. And even then, I mean, there's been some work done about the clause in the 13th Amendment that allows slavery to exist when people are incarcerated. And so there was some pretty nefarious things that were done after the 13th Amendment to ensure that people could be incarcerated and then work as slaves. I mean, this did happen. So Slavery itself, I mean, to say that we're going to celebrate, to pick a day to celebrate, we're going to pick Juneteenth because in Galveston, Texas, some former slaves celebrated their de facto freedom. So we're going to do that throughout the United States. It's perception. It's bad perception. It's faulty perception. Nothing happened. And so one individual wrote me and said, this is evil to say that they should be celebrating something that happened at the point of a bayonet. No, I mean, the 13th Amendment would have been ratified without the South ratifying the amendment. It would have happened anyways. There was some opposition to it, but you would have had enough states to ratify the 13th Amendment without the point of a bayonet that it would have been ratified to begin with. So, and the interesting thing, of course, there is that Lincoln was willing to postpone the 13th Amendment at the Hampton Roads Peace Conference. He was willing to put it off for 5 years or longer. So slavery, if Lincoln had lived, if the South had actually decided in early 1865 they were going to come back in the Union, Lincoln was willing to compensate slave owners for slaves. He was willing to postpone the 13th Amendment. That was negotiable. Everything was on the table. All the South had to do was come back in the Union. Of course, they wouldn't. Jefferson Davis was insisting on independence. Independence was first and foremost. And of course, Davis was also willing to discuss the end of slavery with the Kenner Mission. So this is all wrapped into that. It's perception. The perception that June 19th somehow is a day where slavery ended is just faulty. And no one should celebrate. If you want to celebrate it in Galveston, Texas, because that's a local holiday, fine. But really the day that anyone should be celebrating, and this is also, sometimes you get into the idea that, you know, January, early January, is a day to celebrate the end of slavery because that's when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. Again, false. The day that should be celebrated as Emancipation Day in America is December 6, 1865, the day the 13th Amendment was ratified. Because that's the day slavery legally ended everywhere in America. Didn't matter where you were, didn't matter in the United States, didn't matter if you were in the South or the North. There was no more slavery in the United States. December 6th, if that's the day you want to celebrate, so this is a perception. Okay? The problem is that. And then you look at Confederate monuments. On the flip side of that, the perception is these monuments were built, erected, to perpetuate the idea of slavery, which is completely false. And of course, Philip Lee wrote this piece, and he goes off this chart. We've talked about this on the podcast before, using these statistics. Actually, there was had a couple of pieces on this. In fact, using this exact same chart and saying this is false. When you look at what's happening here, is there something else going on? Is this all about Jim Crow? Is it the fact that by the 1890s into the early 20th century, you're getting to the 50th anniversary of the war, and so people are starting to think about that. The other thing that's going on there, of course, is that Southerners finally had a little bit of cash. They could build monuments. These monuments were about love, not hate. And I know that people bring up, well, somebody said something racist in one of these speeches. Well, okay, Americans in the 19th century and late early 20th century were racist, North and South. But that doesn't mean anything, because it doesn't get into the motivation for building the monument. The monument was about love. It was about respect for people that had died, for those that had fought, for loved ones, brothers, fathers, cousins, grandfathers at some point, uncles, sons. That's what these monuments were about. And they were being built with pennies, literally pennies. People that were sending in as little as they could, or as most as they could, which is oftentimes pennies. These little amounts of money, they were being collected so that people could actually build these monuments. And even Booker T. Washington said that these monuments should be built in the South. Booker T. Washington. Because these monuments represented the best of Southern society, not the worst. And again, they were built through love, through an admiration for people. To say that you have to get rid of these things, that you have to denounce your ancestors. If you're a Southerner who had family members who fought for the Confederacy, by saying you have to denounce this, it's evil. It's immoral. You're saying you have to denounce your own DNA. That is the epitome of evil. You should not even exist if you are saying that. But that's essentially what's happening in America now. And it's about perception. And so you go on any time. I mean, there was just an article that came out. There was in Alexandria, Virginia, there was a street was renamed and taken away from Jefferson Davis. And now it's, I forget what they named it, but it's not Jefferson Davis Highway anymore. It's something else. And so the comments on this was published in The Hill, and the comments on this were all, oh, that traitor needs to go, et cetera. These are just traitors. Get rid of the traitors. And of course, there was a school renamed in Virginia. Jeb Stuart. It was Jeb Stuart that was the name of the school. Now it's Barack Obama School. So, okay. I mean, if you want to change the name of a school, fine. But the reason to do this and the choice of people, I mean, it reflects what's going on in society at large. People are just completely stupid. And I think this is, you have to call it for what it is, stupidity. Barack Obama has no tie to Virginia. None. Barack Obama is from Illinois. I mean, if you just want to say he's from a state, or Hawaii. I could understand in Hawaii or Illinois naming a school after Barack Obama, sure. I mean, you want to be proud of Obama in Illinois. You want to be proud of Obama in Ohio. Okay. But the fact is, he has no attachment to Virginia, whereas Jeb Stuart does. So here's a Virginian being taken off of school in Virginia because of a perception problem. But again, that's the world in which we live. Everything is nationalized now. And so a local holiday, Juneteenth in Texas, which, if you want to say that was the day that some people in Texas decided they're going to celebrate the end of slavery, even though legally slavery hadn't ended, and the Emancipation Proclamation being read, that was a wartime measure, not a peacetime measure, et cetera, whatever you want to say there. You want to somehow justify it, fine. But this is the issue. You have, but all these other people celebrating Juneteenth doesn't make any sense. Just like naming a school after Barack Obama in Virginia doesn't make any sense. Usually people named schools and public buildings after people from those states that were prominent people. And you find this all over the place. Even people that, presidents from those states. You would have a school name. Now, of course, presidents, you might see a little bit of a situation there. We're going to have presidents named in other states, from other states in other states. But, I mean, here is the problem. Jeb Stuart shouldn't have been removed from a school in Virginia, but it's all about perception. And not only that, so we had those two pieces. And then we had one piece on Thursday, Why the South Needs the Electoral College, written by Michael Arnheim. And Michael Arnheim is a pretty prominent constitutional scholar. He's actually a barrister. He's written the Constitution for Dummies, but he's a London barrister, and he's an interesting guy. And of course, this particular piece gets into how the Electoral College protects sectional minorities, like in the South. The South, and of course, the left knows this, and people on the left know this, that what they really want to do is get rid of the Electoral College because it allows for what they believe is the original intent of the United States, which is a direct democracy. I mean, this is what they think. And so there's a push for the National Popular Vote Initiative. And I wrote about this in my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution in 2012. And the idea is that what these states will do is they will allocate their electoral college votes to whoever wins the popular vote. It doesn't matter who wins that state. It only matters who wins the overall popular vote. Now, of course, the popular vote isn't even counted according to the Constitution. This is only something people started doing in 1824. Up until that point, nobody cared about the popular vote. It didn't matter who won the overall popular vote. It only mattered who won the states. And it still only matters who wins the states. It is a real federal feature of the Constitution. There are a few federal features of the Constitution. One is the Electoral College. The other is the Senate, the original Senate, which of course was destroyed by the 17th Amendment. And then you have the way of electing the president if there is less than a majority in the Electoral College, which is the states get to choose the president in the House of Representatives. So the states still have complete control over the executive branch, in theory, and it always was that way, with the states electing the senators, and the senators have advice and consent. The states controlled the executive branch. So what people are trying to do is get rid of that. We're trying to make this government completely national. And if you got rid of the Electoral College, what you would have then is a national government, which is not what the founding generation wanted. Now, so he has a proposal, you know, there are some things we should do, and I'm not going to get into that. The point of all this is, of course, is that the South has, particularly since the 1840s, has always been threatened as a section, for whatever reason. But certainly, the Constitution, the mechanisms in the Constitution that are there to protect minority sections or states are something worth hanging on to. But can the South be protected simply by the Constitution alone? Southerners didn't believe so in 1860 and 61, which is why they left the Union. Moving forward today, can political minorities, sectional minorities, be protected by the Constitution? This is where we've gotten into things like, should California secede? If California firmly believes it cannot be protected, is secession the remedy? Or how about Vermont? There was a strong secession movement in Vermont. How about Hawaii? If these sections, these states, don't believe that they can be protected by the Constitution, which maybe they can't anymore, maybe certain cultures cannot be protected by that, is secession an option? So this is a real conversation to have in the 21st century. As the United States has gotten larger and larger, is it too big? Is the real problem here that we have alien people governing other people? I mean, are Americans angry because of that situation? It's something Dr. Livingston has done a lot of work on. Is America too big? Kirkpatrick Sale, when you look at the size of states, we have a United State. We don't have the United States anymore. We don't have a general government. We have a national government that's going to micromanage every single issue. The reason that we have people going berserk because a Supreme Court justice decides to retire is because we've nationalized everything. It shouldn't really matter at all. None of these issues that go before the court should even go before the court. It should all be handled by the states. But we think because something happens in one state, it affects me. If I live in Alabama and something happens in California that affects me, it doesn't affect me one little bit. Whatever they do in California is what they do in California. I could care less. Whatever they do in Massachusetts is what they do there. Whatever they do in Georgia, right next door, is what they do there. Unless I have to drive through Georgia all the time or live in Georgia, I don't care. Mississippi, what they do in Mississippi is what they do in Mississippi. The people in Mississippi can handle that. In other words, you sweep around your own back steps. You take care of your own backyard. But the problem is we think that we need to be protesting and controlling what everybody else does in every other state. And that's not the way the Union was devised. It's not the way it was designed. In fact, the founding generation talked about this over and over again. We have different climates, different sections, different peoples, different cultures. What may work in the South won't work in the North, and et cetera, and vice versa. And so when it was interesting, if you read the Massachusetts debates when it comes to ratification, because there are people that brought up in Massachusetts, well, I don't know if we want to be in a union with slaveholders, but the proponents of the Constitution, those that wanted it, said, look, what are you worried about? What are you worried about? Those people can't do anything to us. This is a general government. They can't affect what we do in Massachusetts. And those of you that are clamoring for annual elections, why? It's a general government. It has very little power over our domestic concerns. What we want to do in Massachusetts is what we do in Massachusetts. What they want to do in South Carolina is what they do in South Carolina. This was brought up over and over again in Massachusetts. In Connecticut, same thing. You don't have to worry about those Southerners because they're not going to affect us. We get to do whatever we want in the state of Massachusetts or Connecticut outside of these certain powers that we have granted to the general authority and denied ourselves at the state level, which is commerce, international commerce, defense, and that's it. If you look at the Constitution, the two things that the Constitution really is designed to do is to handle trade and defense, commerce and defense. That's it. All the other things are for the states to decide. All these issues, these hot-button issues, whether it's, you know, take your pick, whether it's a left-wing issue like legalization of marijuana, the general government has no control over that. Or Abortion, the general government has no control over that. These are state issues. Always have been. The penal code, when you look at capital punishment, these are state issues. Now, if you want to say the general government, if you want to argue at the general level that about capital punishment, if the federal government can actually pass a law that inflicts capital punishment, well, that would be an Eighth Amendment issue. Otherwise, the state of Alabama or the state of Oklahoma or the state of California can do whatever they want with their own state laws. There's no appeal to the general government in that way. There's no Eighth Amendment issue there. Not even the 14th Amendment did that, and people recognized that when the 14th Amendment was ratified. So the issue here with this, of course, is does the Constitution, is this really our safeguard? Or should there be some other safeguard other than the Constitution? The Constitution hasn't worked for a long time. It's been shredded for well over 150 years. I could even argue the Constitution was shredded in the first Congress when it was ignored with Hamilton's economic program, right? So the Constitution is not your be-all, end-all. This has to be something else, and there has to be some other recourse. This is what Jefferson and Madison were talking about in 1798. The states have to be the bulwarks. They have to be the hedge against unconstitutional authority, not some Supreme Court or some mechanism like the Electoral College. Though I think it's interesting to point out, look, the Electoral College is there to protect the states. There are federal features of the Constitution, and those that are trying to get rid of it know this, which is why they want to get rid of it. Now, the last two pieces of the week have to do with art and museums, and so they're a little discultural here. And there is a perception among Northerners that the South really didn't produce much in the way of art, literature. But this little book, and in fact, I ordered it because I had never seen this, but it's entitled The Art of the Old South, Painting, Sculpture, Architecture, and the Products of Craftsmen in the South from 1560 to 1860. A 300-year period. It's written by Jesse Posch. And it's an interesting book. It's actually more of a coffee table book. It's a thick book. It's got a lot of illustrations in it. And it gets into all the different types of art that were produced in the South. And good stuff, not just, material that people wouldn't recognize as good art. And I actually live in near a city that has a little Southern art museum, and they do things other than just paintings. They have crafts, the work of craftsmen, quilting, for example, your crafts that are also works of art. And so this book covers that little-known part of Southern culture. It needs to be better explored because the South did produce a beautiful array of artwork. Furniture, silver, needlework, pottery, glass. An interesting part of Southern artists is glasswork, etched glass. That's often not known. Furniture. Produced in the South. In fact, High Point, North Carolina used to be the furniture hub of the United States. But architecture, looking at how homes were built, all of this stuff, including painting, all of these things are a beautiful part of what makes the South a uniquely important part of American culture, a real part of American culture. And certainly Southerners were modeling these things, particularly in the colonial period after the English. This is what they loved. But there were real Southern artists and architects. And that is often overlooked. No one goes to an area. When people come to the South, what do they want to see? They want to see plantation homes. They want to see what the Old South brought. That's what they want to see. And in that same vein, there's the article on Wednesday, Shrine of the South by Lewis March. It's a piece on an unknown museum, the Newmarket Battlefield Military Museum in Virginia, New Market, Virginia. This is a personal collection, basically, that turned into a museum. And nobody really knows about it. But it's a wonderful place that people should go visit. And it's one of these little gems of the South, little hidden gems, that shows Southern... Now, this is about the New Market Battle, but it has a tremendous number of artifacts in it from the South, from the war itself, but you know, from the Southern side. And so if you're looking for artifacts, again, a reflection of the Southern people at the time, it's a great place to go because it has anything you want to see there. And the man who created the museum said, look, we just need something like this. We need some place to collect Southern artifacts. And so he did it. It's an expression of the South and Southern culture. And so there are these things all over the place. And it's perception. We're dealing with perception. And so we have to continue to push back against the idea that the South has nothing to offer, that these other things that we talk about, you know, whether it's monuments or holidays, these type of things, there has to be a real tangible thing to it. And you can't just say, well, I mean, we're going to celebrate this because of something that happened here in this local area. You can't just spread that out everywhere else. In monuments, you know, why are these things built? You have to understand the time. This is perception. It's a perception problem. Until next time, good day.